get started. So really excited today because Dr. Dunham is here. He's a colleague of mine and a really good friend as well. He's an assistant professor in the Faculty of Health Sciences. He's also a global health specialist and an epidemiologist. He has a fantastic website that you guys should access for all the good stuff on it. There's some other stuff on it too. So check him out on www.dunanda.com. And again, I'm endorsing all the positive stuff on that website, not all the other stuff that's up there. Also follow him on Twitter because he frequently tweets about really interesting global health opportunities, funding initiatives, jobs, and all that kind of stuff is there as well.
Dirty jokes. What are dirty jokes?
Some dirty jokes. Some there you go. He'll be talking to you today about his community-based health work in Guyana, and he might also touch on India a little bit as well. So on that note, please join me in welcoming Dr. Dunham.
Thank you. So I hurt my back earlier this week, so I've been on medication for several days. So this smile on my face, it's pharmacological. So I'm still slow, forgive me, the drugs are working fine. So as Sonny mentioned, I try to keep a repository of everything I do on my website, which is here. And in fact, I've started this thing where I try to record all my lectures now. So this one is being recorded right now, and I will put the recording on the podcast section of my website later on in the week. So if you don't want to take notes or whatever, just want to enjoy yourself, feel free to go there. It also means if you say something, it will also be on the record. And these slides, some version thereof, will also be there too if Sonny hasn't already put it online. So what I'm going to do today is talk randomly about the work that I do in Guyana and some other places, and hopefully some form or shape will take in that random discourse. I got a bunch of slides, I'll talk over them. Because you're third year development students, you've heard most of the stuff already. What I'm hoping you get out of this is some of the real life challenges, barriers, opportunities, interesting tidbits, and quirks of working in the field. So how many of you have heard of Guyana before? Excellent. Have you been there? No, all right, that's good. All right, so let's start with that. There it is, tiny little country in the north of South America. And it's about the size of England, but a population smaller than that of Ottawa, a population of about 700,000 people, and it's diminishing, which sounds unusual, right? So there are some countries in the world, low-income countries, that in fact are not experiencing population explosion. They're in fact contracting. And Guyana is one of them. Can you imagine why they're contracting? What's the major component?
Migration,
exactly. No one's dying off in mass numbers. They're having kids. Everyone's leaving. In fact, anyone you meet there probably has a relative in Canada or the USA or Britain and is in the process of trying to leave. And it creates a certain barrier when you're trying to work there because you always try to ethically engage the population, maybe do some capacity building around the human resources, maybe hire locals and give them training to upgrade their skill sets and things like that. But then they will turn around and use that upgraded skill set as leverage to leave. So the larger ethical question becomes, am I encouraging the betterment of this society, or in fact, am I doing damage to this society? That's on the side. That's one of the many tidbits I'll throw at you, and maybe it'll take some kind of form. And feel free to stop me anytime, because I don't know where I'm going with this. I'm just going to talk. Okay? So I said it's about the size of England and underpopulated, and everyone lives right on the coast. And the rest of the country is one of the world's last untouched rainforests. So all the work that I do is actually deep in the interior, and it's a great joy to go and see one of mankind's last repositories of genetic wealth. I have some photos from those areas I'll show you in a second. So again, random slides that I've cobbled together from other presentations. When I train my people to go into the interior, I use some of these slides too, so a lot of them aren't really relevant to you. I'll skip over them. Just a little background. The Caribbean region is one of the WHO regions. WHO defines administrative regions. There's something called CARICOM, which is the Community of Caribbean Nations. It's an economic union. Guyana is one of those member states. And there's something called CARIC, which is the Caribbean Epidemiology Center. And they are the repository of most population health data in that region. So if you're looking to do anything health-related on a population basis in the Caribbean, CARIC is often the first stop, or at least a partner you want to get to know. So when you think of the Caribbean, and by the way, I say Caribbean, not Caribbean. There's no right way or wrong way. I say Caribbean because why? Who knows why? Why do I say Caribbean, not Caribbean? Where does the name come from? You know? comes from the Carib Indians, who were amongst the largest indigenous group prior to the arrival of Europeans. So it's not the Carib Indians, it's the Carib, not the Carib, Carib. So it's the Caribbean, not the whatever. You know what I'm saying, right? So if you ever struggle with which pronunciation to use, use that one because there's a reason. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. All right. Most people think of this. White sandy beaches and blue waters. This is not Guyana. Not at all. Guyana, in fact, has no real beaches except for ones in the interior that are somewhat manufactured, and the water is black. And I'll show you pictures of black water in a second. So this is, you know, what the Caribbean looks like. Obviously, you think of these nations mostly. But the nations that jut forth from South America are also technically Caribbean. And Guyana is one of those. It's both a South American nation and a Caribbean nation. And the projects that I've been involved with, a big one was something called the Public Health Strengthening Project, funded by your generous tax dollars. Thank you very much. The tune of $7 million, where we tried to remake the local public health system around HIV and around TB and around STDs, using laboratory skills, using village-based training, the training of village workers to step up into other kinds of roles, and laboratory strengthening, and lastly, building a health information system across the country. That was the vision. We were going to make this integrated health information system using open access networks and all this stuff so that we can track patients from clinic to clinic and all this wonderful surveillance data. But then politics stepped in, and we experienced a lot of pressure. You can probably guess from where. If you can't guess, then we can have that discussion. That forced us to go from open access to licensed software. We went from Apache servers to Microsoft, right? And suddenly we couldn't afford to do that nation-spanning project anymore, and it got constrained down to a couple of sites in two different cities. So that's one of the barriers. I'm going to sort of posit a seed there, is the political corporate agendas often get in the way of doing grand, inexpensive work. So I engage in missions to the interior. I consult to an NGO in Toronto called Beit Hafta. They're a Jewish group. I'm not Jewish, doesn't matter. Part of their religious mandate is to do these endeavors in other countries to give their membership opportunity to do volunteer work. And they have a lot of doctors as members, so they start engaging in these missions to the interior. And so I join them to mold their ethics behavior a bit more rationally and to give them some insight into Guyana as well. And I started doing some village-based science education projects. We have a trip to a prison that we looked at to see what the prison population was experiencing. And I'll show you some stuff later on. Okay, that is Guyana, size of inland. Everyone lives right along here. It's got really one city, it's Georgetown. These are regions, they're numbered, they're like provinces. There are somewhat autonomous administrative zones. Some have governors and some don't. But that's the main city. And here is a place called Mount Roraima. Maybe you've heard of that name before, no? The Venezuelans claimed it also. It's from the Venezuelan border. Ever read Arthur Conan's Doyle, The Lost World? Or heard of it? See the movie? You know, Victorian era story of dinosaurs rampaging. No, really? No, come on. No? Okay. So Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World, is a takeoff on that novel. So in that novel, Conan Doyle postulates the existence of dinosaurs today. And those stories came to him from reports from Victorian explorers in the Roraima area, because it's a plateau. Ever seen Up? Disney's Up. Okay, that's based on the same place. Okay, and the plateau is so ancient and so secluded that for the longest time, biologists thought that if dinosaurs still exist, that they exist there. Okay, so it really is a genetically rich, unique biological center of protected flora and fauna that predate our continents. Go back to the era of Gondwana land. I can talk forever about the geology of space. I'm not bothered. Okay, let's move on. So, look at that. So, unique flora and fauna, all right? Last untouched rainforest, blah, 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 stuff I said. So this is a shot from the interior. This actually, it's not quite a giant pineapple, but it's like a giant pineapple. It's a pineapple family. And it's a land of giants, so there are giant otters, giant eagles, giant alligators, giant snakes. Once I saw a giant harpy owl, you know, the interior, and I was with a small Amerindian child, and he's about the size of me, you know, and just staring at me, and no, take the child. Carry the child. So, right. So, and this, you know what that is? Anyone know? That is a bed of carnivorous plants. right? So they're all over the place in this area, and meat-eating plants. And when I show this picture to like public school kids, they all say, "How do you get across that? You walk on it." Because in a fight between me and a plant, I always win. It's not just going, hey, hey, hey. Yeah, so, but it's ancient, it's prehistoric. You know, that's an orchid. They're all over the place. These are probably worth tens of thousands of dollars in a London orchid show. But how you transport them and all that. That's the biological richness we're looking at there. This is a golden rocket frog. So this is the touristing aspect of today's presentation. See the pretty pictures now. So this frog is about the size of half of my pinky nail. And it lives inside an amaryllis plant. And around the region that I'm going to show in a second, in the interior, there's a cluster of these plants in the entire zone that don't exist anywhere else in the world. And inside the plant, one or two of these frogs will live, and they'll live their entire life cycle in that plant. And there may be, I could be wrong about this, a couple of species of this golden rocket frog that whose skin exudes a substance that is several times more potent than cocaine. So if you touch it, you may die of a heart attack. Right? Now, that's, I don't know if that's true or not, that's what I'm told. This thing is tiny, tiny, tiny. Bright birds. Now, if you know anything about jungle exploration, one of the ways that you test for the health of a jungle or rainforest is the presence of bright birds. Why? Why do bright birds tell us that a place is probably healthy and untouched? Can you guess? When people arrive, what's the first thing they do? Capture bright birds. Right? So if there are bright birds running around, there are not a lot of people, usually. That's a good sign. So lots of bright parakeets. So this is the world's highest single-drop waterfall. It's called Kaichur, and it's in that zone here. And it's around here that you find those amaryllis plants with the golden rocket frogs living in it. And this is probably the country's only tourist attraction, and maybe 100 people a year will go to it. You've got to take a bush plane in the interior. It's too expensive for locals to go. I've been there a number of times. You can stand right at the very top and look down because no one cares. Right? Fall over and die. Maybe about 20 people have ever been to the bottom, you know, of the falls there. From thousands of miles around, hundreds of miles around, it's just untouched jungle. And maybe a handful of people have seen what's behind the falls. What's behind there is a family of starlings. So again, a unique, untouched wealth of biodiversity. Okay. Ooh, look at that. So now we're down here, near the Brazilian border, and rainbow, savanna. So again, it shows the diversity of the landscapes and the ecosystems. We went from dense jungle to savanna, where anteaters roam, you know, and horses. And it's a very Brazilian Portuguese culture down here. Right, history. The important parts here is that it goes back to the arrival of Columbus. When Columbus arrived, he identified the Carib Indians, and the whole Caribbean thing began. The Dutch took control for the longest time, the French and the British. Today, there are in fact three Guyanas. There is British Guyana, Dutch Guyana, and French Guyana. British Guyana today we call the Guyana, Dutch Guyana we call Suriname, and French Guyana we call La Guyane. Okay, now British Guyana, who I'm talking about today, is the only English-speaking country in South America. I was born there. That's why I speak English, but it's kind of a patois English. I'll give you examples later on if you want. Right, and Suriname is Dutch-speaking, and it still maintains close ties with the Netherlands, and La Guyane is pretty much under the thumb of France still, and La Guyane is, I like to think of it as one part rocket base and one part prison, because that's what it's famous for. They launched the European Ariane rockets from there, and they have Devil's Island prison there also. Have you seen Louis Papillon? That takes place in French Guiana. But we don't talk about Suriname or La Guyane today, it's all about the English version. But at one point, it was all one big Guyana. And it was colonized to raise sugarcane, to grow sugarcane. And sugarcane is what really changed the world in the 1700s, 1800s, because prior to that, sugar was not easily come by. So Caribbean-based sugar changed the world economics and may have brought about diabetes or diseases like that, too. So all this stuff is interwoven into world economics and world health and world history. Never forget that. So, gold. All right. So Guyana is minerally quite wealthy. There are some people who believe there are more diamonds in Guyana than there are in South Africa. Certainly, in the interior at some points, I swear you can see the gold actually sparkling at the bottom of the rivers. That's where Richard is. There are scores of gold mines in the interior, many of whom are owned by Canadians. And this is a problem, because gold mining is deleterious very often to the health and welfare of Indigenous peoples. Have you studied mining at all, the effects of mining? A little bit? Okay, so it's important that we understand this. This university is based a lot on mining wealth, which is a bit, you know, problematic when we have these conversations. You know, I tell you stories of some of my colleagues who have been chastised when we bring this to the forefront a bit too often. But Canadian companies are quite at the forefront of doing damage to these societies, unintentionally so, but in knowledge of it. So if you know anything about gold mining, for example, gold mining requires the use of certain heavy chemicals to extract the gold from the rock. Among those chemicals are cyanide. So very often in the interior, you'll find a man-made lake of cyanide. We call it a tailings pond. And this lake of cyanide is spread out about a kilometer wide, is there to evaporate the cyanide, because cyanide is biodegradable. But very often, the cyanide will leach into the local water supply, and will, not very often, but occasionally, and will deleteriously affect a local community. That's an obvious way that the mining affects people. Another way is, who works in mines? Well, men work in mines. So the men will come from local communities, drawn by the promises of better wages. Suddenly they're concentrated in these areas. Meanwhile, the work they were going to do in their villages doesn't get done. What kind of work? Well, crop raising, things like that. So suddenly there's a deficit of food. Meanwhile, who is coming to service these men who are now in clusters and barracks and mining camps? Prostitutes from Brazil migrate north. So now we have sexual disease problems. We have some familial domestic issues that are discordant, right? We have food not being produced. Where does the food come from then? Well, this new wealth that comes from mining is being used to purchase food from abroad. What kind of food can you send into the interior? Not the healthiest kind. You're not importing kale from England. I mean, you're bringing in dried biscuits and things like that. So these things do not lead to the best kinds of health outcomes. Then you have the arrival of alcohol. Now, alcohol is a parallel story that runs throughout all of this, especially dealing with Amerindian peoples who have maybe slightly more susceptibility to alcohol than others due to alcohol dehydrogenase, an enzyme that we tend to have or don't have. Okay, I'm talking about a lot of random stuff here. The point I'm trying to make is what we see in places like Guyana, due to their mineral wealth, is the arrival of corporate interests that may cause bad effects amongst the locals. Right? I have here Eldorado rum as Eldorado. You've heard the story of Eldorado, the legend of Eldorado? Well, one legend has it that Eldorado was in Guyana, the city of gold, because there's so much gold coming out of there. There's actually a little mountain there called Eldora. Right, and so the local rum company is called Eldorado, and it's the second best rum in the world, so I highly recommend you get some Guyanese rum. The best rum being Jamaican, just so you know. Alright, okay, so the history is, important parts here is slaves were used, African slaves were used to run the plantations for the longest time. 1834, an amazing thing happened in world history. The British decided to end slavery at their end. That's quite the story in and of itself. Okay, and as a result, they set themselves up for a bit of economic struggle, and they needed someone to replace all of the manpower in that region, and they brought in the indentured service system. Have you heard of this before? Indentured service is a kind of legalized slavery, where people sign over their bodies for a period of time to, you know, to be abused, really, in exchange that promised something. My ancestors were amongst those who were indentured servants, and they're brought in to, you know, replace the black slaves who were running the sugar fields. Now, long story short, things didn't quite work out the way they planned. So 100 years later, we have a community, a society made up mostly of Asians who are descendants of indentured servants. The next largest group are Africans who are descendants of African slaves, and then a smattering of other kinds of races, all of whom were kind of brought there a little bit against their will. So you can imagine the kinds of cultural tensions that arise. Okay, politics, let's skip over that stuff. Important part is independence came in the 60s. Then there was some interference from the powers that be, in this case the British and the Americans, having to do with the local powers wanting to have associations with Cuba and the Soviet Union. And so some meddling was done. That led to a tyranny over a couple decades. Long story short, Jimmy Carter arrived in 1992. For U.S. president to institute the first fair elections there, and after that, a particular party won power, and they have kept power up until today. The somewhat multiracial party, which is actually a pro-East Asian party. So the politics there are confusing and very race-driven. So the lesson here is the history is critical. If you want to understand a country, if you want to work there, you have to understand the history and the politics and the economics, especially around things that may not be overt, like race. So when I first arrived there on my first consulting gig in the early 2000s, I'm from that country, I know the system well. We're meeting with the Minister of Health, and the elephant in the room is race, and no one wants to say it, but everyone has to understand it. It was something like, you know, we want to train these people over here, send them to Jamaica for training, but we can't because they're the wrong race, and the current powers that be are the wrong race also. So there's subtleties here you have to recognize if you want to get things done. You have to ask yourself, how much are you willing to push your values versus their values? And we find a, you know, come to a middle ground. Right. So here are some of the key players. By the way, she was the wife of this guy who was like the founding father of Guyana, John Deo, and she became president after he died, and she's a white Jewish woman from the U.S. So think about that. A white Jewish woman from the United States was once the president of a third world country in South America. How come there's no movie? I don't understand this. Right? That's weird. Okay, so the economy. Why are we there in the first place? For economic reasons. When the fair elections came in, they came with at a time of serious economic strife, and that led to the arrival of the IMF that offered a loan, right? Now, you've studied the IMF, I assume, in your program? Okay, so you know it comes with a structural adjustment package, and that involved the reduction in the currency value, opening of the markets, and things like that. As a result, today, fast forward today, the Guyana that I go to today resembles nothing of what it looked like 10 years ago. There's incredible amounts of infrastructure. There, I mean, little things you take for granted. Oh my God, there's a stoplight. I've never seen a stoplight before. That's amazing. There's pavement. Oh my God. Now I can drive from the airport downtown, and if your car broke down 10 years ago, someone's going to kill you. Let's be honest. Now it's like, oh, look, there's a cell phone network. I can call for help. And maybe they'll get. I remember, like, I was like 10 years ago, there was a crime wave happening, right? And it was done by essentially four guys, right? But it was so serious that CETA gave our program director essentially a tank, this heavy armored vehicle, to get her to the airport. I had to make my own way, a taxi. I'm just a consultant, she's an employee. That's a little bit of an overkill. Anyway, so we see infrastructure increasing, you know, enormous hotels are going up. The place looks quite developed, more so than it did a long time ago. However, the standard of living is even less than it was 10 years ago because real wages have come down. And this is the economic angle you have to keep your eye on all the time. Just because things look better, they may not be better as a lived experience. So what that ends up meaning is the ability to purchase food is diminished. The ability to put your child in school has diminished. The ability to pay for your rent has diminished. And so those at the extreme end of the poverty scale are more disenfranchised than ever before. On the other hand, those in the middle to the high area have more opportunity. So in many ways, in my observations, the efforts we have made on a global economic level and at a structural adjustment level have benefited perhaps a majority, but have really hurt a large minority. Okay. Right, the barriers to development right now is HIV. HIV is huge there. It's probably the second highest prevalence in the hemisphere. Who's got the first highest in the Western Hemisphere? That is correct. Ding, 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 ding. That is correct, sir. You win nothing. Right. So official prevalence rate is about 2 to 3%, but it's probably higher than that because people don't report HIV. And it's, I'll tell you some HIV stories because they're fun stories. Okay, they're fun, horrible stories. So when I first arrived there, there was one janitorourinary medical clinic. That's where you go to for your STD issues and your AIDS issues in the capital city. It's a small society. Remember, we're talking about 700,000 people. So chances are, when you walk in, someone's going to see you. And hey, I saw Bob walking in the AIDS clinic. Yeah. So the stigma issues are quite profound. That's the first problem. Second is, who are the people running it? Well, I mentioned that we have an HR issue, we believe in all the time. First year we come, there is a senior doctor running it. That's great. He leaves. Second year, there's a medium-level doctor running it. He leaves. Third year, there's a junior doctor running it. She leaves. Next year, there's a medical student running it. Yeah, so it's very rapidly the quality of leadership and clinical care diminished because of the HR exodus. And at one point, the person running the clinic was also a militant fundamentalist Christian who was opposed to the lifestyles of the people he was treating. So he's on TV, you know, picketing against gay people, meanwhile all his patients are gay. And so it's a problem, you know, with them. Right, so there it is. This is a traditional, when I say traditional, I don't mean in the sense that it goes back thousands of years. Or, I mean, this is what people live in for many decades. And it's on stilts. Why is it on stilts, the house? Well, yeah. Rainwater, yes and no. Guyana is under sea level. So, in fact, flooding happens all the time. The northern edge of the country has a wall built by the Dutch, the seawall, that holds out the ocean. And it's not well maintained. And so occasionally the sluices will fail and the place will flood. And so you gotta be able to be above it all. Now this is a good story. So one time I was doing the talk show run in Georgetown. Everyone's got a talk show, by the way. In the developing world, everyone's got a TV show. Because if you haven't got the management of your airwaves, then they're open to everyone. Hey, I want a TV show. Fine, I'll play it on, I'll broadcast. And the easiest thing to broadcast that doesn't require any infrastructure, again, is talk shows. So people would run talk shows out of their basement and have a set of camera there, and they broadcast. The Burbese News was broadcast at the back of someone's kitchen, and you hear the dogs barking outside. You know, and I say so with great affection for it. I think it's kind of clever. So I'm doing all these, you know, basement TV shows. Now, one of our trips that we were there, they were debating a gay rights bill in Parliament. This is enormous. A gay rights bill in Parliament of a developing world country, okay? And these individuals were also doing the talk show run. They are male prostitutes, right, who are dressed a certain way, obviously, and they're coming to the show, and they happen to coincide with my visit to one TV show. And the camera guys were just scared of them, not going anywhere near them, and all that, so it was unfortunate. But we're having a chat. And at one point, the host of the show asked them, have you ever been tested for HIV? And they all said, oh yeah, we've been tested, we're fine, we're all negative. And they meet me, it's great, I get my card, it's wonderful. I get back to the office in Georgetown, and there's a phone call from them saying that, in fact, they're all HIV positive, and they're scared to death, and they don't know what to do. Let me back up now. I remember, we do all this training before you go to a country like Guyana. At the time, it was thought of to be an unsafe place. It is an unsafe place. It's not as unsafe as other places. It's not South Africa, right? It's not the cartel-run areas of Colombia, but it can be unsafe. And so, I mean, Sita told us, under no circumstances, go out at nighttime, you know? If you can avoid it, don't go out in daytime either. Yeah. Anyway, but here we are. But these gentlemen wanted to talk to me in candor. And they said, you know, come meet us at this bar in the red light district at 2 in the morning. So I said, all right. So there I was in the red light district waiting for gay hookers. You know, if I die here, then that's what the story will say. And they didn't show up. So I got stood up by gay hookers in Guyana. Hopefully they're okay. This is University of Guyana. I don't know what that's for. So, what do they make? We export sugar, gold, all that wonderful stuff, molasses, rum, timber. This is another example of the economy being a bit problematic. So a lot of the trade relationships countries like Guyana have are in fact harmful. And the example I'll give you is the wood that we use to make matches from. Guyana grows it. They export it to Trinidad, who then makes the matches, sells them back to Guyana for profit. So what's the point? So that's an old colonial model. You study colonialism, remember? In Africa, that was a very standard cycle. Raw materials go here, value added, come back here, and wealth goes back up. So the cycle being a steady drain on resources. So it's kind of the same thing we're seeing here, but it's changing. And one of the ways it's changing is, in fact, through a little bit of creativity. So the previous president of Guyana had the bright idea, out of his idea, someone told to him, of trying, instead of chopping down the rainforest, which is what everyone wants to do all the time, of selling the carbon credits of the rainforest. So he went to the British Parliament and says, we won't chop down a rainforest, I want you to pay us not to. In exchange, we will give you the equivalent of our carbon credits you can exchange on the European market, if that's worth anything. I don't know if that's worth anything anymore. And as far as I know, nothing came of that, except I think a Scandinavian country took them up on it a couple of years ago and started paying them not to chop down the rainforest. So that's, you know, that's progress. I think it's progress. So the population, again, when I made this slide, it was 800,000. Now it's down 100,000. Okay, so net loss of people. Here's the racial makeup. You know, it is a multiracial society, and I'll, as example here is the Miss Guyana pageant. Yeah, three different races represented there. The other thing people don't consider is it is a hyper religious country, and you will find this a lot when you do international work, especially in low income countries. So most of sub-Saharan Africa hyper religious as well. In Guyana, the Christianity is deep, and so if you are not a religious person, I am not a religious person at all. You have to realize that this is a leap that you must take to meet people at their own level. So when we send students there, I tell them, I highly advise you to spend time in the churches. And most of the students are atheists, so just suck that up. You know, just go to the church. That's where you go to meet people and engage with people, and they will trust you if they see you there. And if you have to make announcements, you make it in the churches, because that's where things will happen. And if you have to contextualize your messaging in a religious format, then so be it, to the extent to which you are comfortable, obviously. Okay. So, for example, when trying to do some village education on nutrition, we can talk about, well, there's artificial foods and there's natural foods, and natural foods are better than artificial foods. But it means more to them if you say, there's man-made food and there's food made by God, right? But that's what sells it. And, you know, we're saying exactly the same thing, but that means something in that context. So I prefer to use that verbiage, because that carries some weight. All right, churrascaria, Brazilian barbecue. I'm a failed vegetarian, part-time vegetarian. So I'm in Guyana, I suspend those beliefs, because the Brazilian meat travels far. So churrascaria is a Brazilian barbecue. I show this because as indication of the influx of Brazilian culture. Again, this is something you have to keep in mind all the time. The fluidity of geopolitics. So Brazil is encroaching heavily on this country. Why do you think Brazil wants Guyana? What's the value in Guyana to Brazil? Sure, gold resource, all the stuff is there. Anything else you can think of? Why does the Soviet Union want Afghanistan?
Other than that,
so a physical resource of some kind, access to a port, right? So if you can have ready access to a Caribbean port, that reduces your export cost dramatically. So a long road from Brazil up through Guyana up to the Caribbean is actually a great boon for them. And very often they're always debating whether or not they can actually do this in a partnership. If they do it, the Guyanese realize it's pretty much the death of Guyanese culture, because Brazil will overwhelm Guyanese culture, I believe. And I think in 100 years, it will be Brazilian anyway. That's what we're dealing with. Okay, I mentioned the language. Again, this is something that you have to deal with when you do development work. You think you know the language, you don't really know the language. We can say, oh, in this country, they speak French. So that's not even French I know, right? This country speak Arabic. Well, that's not the Arabic I'm aware of. Guyana, English-speaking country. Here's an example of the English in Guyana, in the backwaters of Guyana. I meet you on the bridge one day, and you say to me, Awa, and I say, Mede, and you walk on. That's Guyanese English. It means nothing to you, right? It's a kind of patois. So you've probably heard that phrase before, but linguistically, this is how these things work. When two cultures that don't speak each other's language meet for the first time, they create a pidgin language, P-I-D-G-I-N. Pidgin is what we use to just trade, you know, take, give, me, whatever, you know. And when a pidgin is taught to a second generation as their first language, then it's called a Creole. But there are different kinds of Creoles also. There's English lexicon Creoles, French lexicon Creoles. We use the word Creole to mean French culture from Louisiana. It actually has a deep linguistic meaning. So in Guyana, it's an English lexicon Creole, but there are elements from Hindi, from Senegalese, from Portuguese, and from the Amerindian languages too. And the deeper you go into the interior, the deeper the Creole gets, the more accented it gets also. Right, so even though the heading says English, good luck. Right. You can get by with English, but it will label you as I'm a development worker, and I have access to other people of my education status. When I go into the villages, I can do certain things, but I can't go perhaps as deeply as I would like. And if it's time left, I think there will be time, I want to give you some ethical scenarios to work through from Guyana to see if you can find a solution to some of the real ethical conundrums that we encountered in the field. Okay, some stats. Just to show, what we're dealing with here. I've compared Guyana with Canada here. So life expectancy in Canada, this is female to male, 84 years, 77 years if you're male. In Guyana, it's significantly smaller. Literacy levels are quite high. Now, literacy you have to be careful with, because the threshold for being deemed literate is actually quite low globally. So if you look at a country's literacy rates, do not misconstrue that to mean, oh, they read Shakespeare and Tolstoy. It means you could probably, read the directions to get to the grocery store or whatever. So it still requires a lot of work to engage someone in the manner in which they communicate. The important parts here are there are some key indicators of development status that I like to point people to all the time. The first, infant mortality. Look at this, 31, 5. We always hover around 5. That's our baseline in Canada. Rest of the world, pretty high. So that's always an indication of a poorly responsive healthcare system. Maternal mortality is not a big one. 125 per deaths per 100,000 births. That's enormous. We have like 4. That's our, those are 2 big ones. And that's the first thing I always look at for a country, to see the quality of their healthcare system. So the program we did in the 2000s with your tax money, thank you very much, we tried to remake their healthcare system. I think we may have failed. We tried our best. We left behind some products. We changed some laboratories. We trained a lot of people. We made some good, good partnerships. I think I had greater expectations that they're unrealistic. But we won an award for it, for being the best project of the year by CETA. So here's an example of some of the stuff you may be. The kinds of positive change you can make are enormous with very little effort. If you do it smartly and systemically, not systematically, but systemically, and with looking at incremental change and through capacity building. Here's an example. Just training someone how to use a database, we sent some students down to do that for a summer, changed the way a clinic worked permanently. They keep better records now. They can monitor the incoming and outgoing patients. They can monitor their success rates. And that took, an hour per nurse to train them? That's a very small investment for maximum output. Here's one of the labs we made, a TB testing lab, for TB stuff. You know what DOTS is, D-O-T-S? You heard of DOTS? Those are DOTS? Development people never heard of DOTS. Wow. Okay, so DOTS stands for Directly Observed Therapy Short Course. It is the WHO-mandated treatment for tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is one of the great plagues of our time. It always has been and probably always will be. Okay, and the way DOTS works is the biggest barrier to treating tuberculosis is adherence to the treatment. People will feel better when they stop taking the drugs, or the drugs make them feel bad and they stop taking them, and so drug resistance gets built in. The way DOTS works is we send someone on a motorcycle to your home where you're sequestered in quarantine because no one wants to see you because you got tuberculosis. Right? Take your pill, have some food, I watch you take your pill. All right, good. I go back, come back the next day, take your pill, I watch you. All right, good. Every day for as long as the therapy goes on, that way I know that you are complying with your therapy. Right, so it is considered to be the gold standard for treating tuberculosis. Does it actually work? There's debate. So I won't tell you that it does work. I'll say this is what we're supposed to do. So one of the things we did here is we trained a core of DOTS workers, gave them motorbikes, gave them stuff, and sent them out, and hopefully they cured some people. The other project I work on is I mentioned that the Jewish NGO Ve'ahavta, they used to send teams into the interior. We stopped doing that a couple years ago when we switched over to a model of putting students in villages for several months at a time. And I'll tell you why. You probably can guess why we switched over. Because the medical model was we took a team anywhere from 7 people to like 20 people, flew them down with a lot of equipment on bush planes in the deep interior, set up essentially MASH units, mobile clinics, and villagers would come from scores of miles around on boats in like dugout canoes, line up for care, and then we leave. What is wrong with that model? It's unsustainable, it's expensive, it's inefficient. Why do we do it then? Because everyone knows it's inefficient, unsustainable. Why is it done? That's the big one. The other thing is it gives these clinicians an opportunity to have an experience. So that's not the best reason, but I advocate for the NGO to just be honest about our reasons here. We pretend that we're about the outcome, and we are about the outcome, but we're also about the experience of the individuals, and that's how we rationalize doing it. So a lot of issues came up with that kind of work. One of them is there's already a healthcare worker in the interior in a particular community. It's usually a woman, it's usually a local that the government has trained, and we call them MedExes, medical extenders. A medical extender is something between a nurse and a doctor. It's a local with sufficient medical training to handle pretty much anything that comes along. That's not really serious, like, you know, requiring surgery or something like that. Right? So if a bunch of wealthy white Toronto doctors flies down there and does all of the care, how do you think the medical extender is now perceived? It's being a bit lesser quality, right? So bit by bit, we were denigrating the status of their own caregivers, and so that had to be fixed. So we looked in ways of bringing her on board, things like that. People would tend to wait for us. They'd know we'd come back next year, so they hold on to the medical issues and wait for us to show up. Dog, I got this pain in my knees, so yeah, well, this, we're not dealing with that. We're dealing with HIV this time. Knee pain next year. Right? So they weren't getting continuous care. So the old adage, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, very true when it comes to development work. So we tried to liaise a lot with locals. We did, you know, exactly as we could. We dealt primarily with Aboriginals, the Amerindians, because they are the most disenfranchised people in this population, in any population, as you know, globally. Right? So let's see what we have here. A little bit about the Amerindians here. The Amerindians have been pushed from the coast down into the interior. So they are the people of the interior. When I tell public school kids about a time in the jungle with, you know, people down there, they're picturing, you know, the Hollywood stereotype of Amerindians with the loincloths and the piercings and all that stuff. And piercing stuff do exist. When I show them pictures, I'll show you pictures, you find men and women in business suits, you know, and laptop computers and cell phones and things like that, because they're modern people, just happen to live in the interior and they're poor. It's the only difference. They're fully aware of what's going on here. In fact, the first time I arrived in the interior, you know, you're mobbed by a bunch of children who want to see your cell phone and they want to ask about how many megapixels your camera has and all this stuff. Oh, cool. Right, so do not infantilize individuals. And they're the poorest. Cultural identity is being slowly bled away, largely through intermarriage. I was talking to a village captain just 2 months ago when I was there. And he was saying, yeah, I went to this meeting of captains of Amerindians, and I was stunned to find this one guy who looked African. He had, you know, he had the Afro, he had dark skin, and he was saying he's an Amerindian. And I looked into it, yeah, he totally is. But he's just, all this intermarriage has made him sense. He's a black man who's an Amerindian, right? And there are people who look like me, Indians, who are also Amerindians. So the racial distinctiveness is going away, but the cultural distinctiveness not so much. Here is a picture of a child approaching us on a dugout canoe. That's essentially a tree that's been cut down and dug out. So Guyana doesn't have a lot of roads. It has rivers. In fact, the word in an Amerindian language means land of many waters, because waters are everywhere. That's how you get around. And you have to engage people who live in the interior on the waterways. Ah, okay. So here's an Amerindian I met who was making moonshine. That's why I have got healthy glow on my face. So alcohol is a big problem in all Amerindian communities, and I'm part of that big problem because I like alcohol. So, He and I were drinking the a local brew made from cassava. Cassava is a root vegetable. So it's their equivalent of potato in our culture, their major starch, which has enormous implications for how they view themselves. So endless numbers of medical missions come in, and we see the biggest medical problem, can you guess what it is, amongst Amerindians? Can you guess?
Liver problems?
You jump ahead for the alcohol stuff. No, it's diabetes is correct. Ding, 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 ding. Two prizes for you. Look at that. Right? So, and so that's true globally. Hey, it's for us as well. And no one's quite sure why. There are a lot of theories. But it's easy to point to the starches in your diet. And so people are like, oh, like cassava, this lump of white starch you eat all the time. That's got to be the problem. And so a kind of self-hatred gets inculcated here. You know, the food of my people going back thousands of years is what's killing me now. Why is that? I must be a bad person because it didn't kill my grandparents, it's killing me. Right? So we have to really be careful how we communicate this stuff and make sure it's actually true. I'm not convinced that cassava is the problem. I think so. Lifestyle factors, some other factors too. But as a result of other social and biological factors, alcoholism is prevalent. And this leads to domestic violence, it leads to unemployment, it leads to mental illness. And so a lot of these communities have outlawed the importation of alcohol. But they can't outlaw the local production of alcohol. So this guy was making the local brew, which traditionally is made from cassava and saliva. The amylase from your saliva is a fermenting factor. I'm not sure if he did or not, I didn't ask, I'm just drinking. Right, so. Okay, so playing cricket on the beach. Right. So this is the black water. I showed you the picture of the beaches before. This is not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with Amazonian black water. So it looks like tea, because it kind of is tea. So black water is more acidic. It's less nourishing than white water is. And is caused, well, I'm not entirely sure, but the prevailing theory is the leaves and the vegetation there exude a kind of tannin like tea, and essentially dyes the water. And it's kind of creepy because floating around in the water, and you can't see your hand this far beneath, and who knows what else is there. Because there are monsters in those rivers, literal monsters. And I keep telling myself, no, there are no monsters here. I'm all right. Okay, so this is a Google map of where some of our trips are, deep, deep, deep in the interior to what's called the Mazruni area, near the Mazruni River. And the closest large community would be Barnica, which is the gateway city to the mining interior. So all the expeditions, all of the miners, all the big companies fly into Barnica, and then they go by boat or bush plane out. And by the way, it's solid, solid jungle. If your bush plane goes down, you'll never see you again. In fact, one time I went there and someone's bush plane did go down before we arrived, and no one ever found it ever, because it's gone. We once had to go down there, and it was like December in Toronto, and I didn't want to go. And we'll sleep in the plane, and I wake up, and I'm alone with a pilot and a little boy over the jungle. I'm looking down, like, oh, really? And the boy's got a birthday cake. No luggage, a birthday cake. And we land in the middle of nowhere, and it's an airstrip, right? And I got to wait for my contacts to come. I've got all the supplies and stuff. And the plane takes off, and the little boy and his birthday cake go wander off into the bush. I'm thinking, this is weird. I mean, did I die as purgatory? Am I, just anyway. So this is actually, remember that landing strip, middle of nowhere? This is what it is. It's a mile-long landing strip, and it's got a village has grown around it to service the planes that land. This is the police station. It looks beautiful, right? It's quite lovely in the interior. I love the interior. It's quite lovely. But very politicized. Elections going on. Yeah, you have to be. Okay, another lesson comes out of here is you never understand the politics locally. You can try, never give your opinion. If someone asks you, what do you think about this? I'll respond with, I don't know, what do you think about that? Right? Even though I do have opinions, you don't know who you're talking to. So, yeah. A local store in the middle of nowhere, all that stuff enormously expensive because it's all flown in by bush plane. Now here we are, here I am giving a talk to some public school kids in the middle of nowhere. Right? It's an Amerindian school, and they're quite lovely. It's clean, it's beautiful, you know? And it's a sexual health lecture, So here we are putting condoms on big black penises. People are afraid to laugh, I know. So I want to give you the first ethical conundrum. Okay, so one of these communities, a really remote one, from here, we have to take a dugout canoe another 2 hours over rapids to get to. Now, in that other community, there are about 300 people who live there, and there's a residential high school run by fundamentalist Christians, because the entire country is fundamentally Christian. And villagers from miles around will drop off their kids by canoe, and they live in the high school, and they leave, right? And we know the teenagers are having all kinds of sex. We know they're probably at risk for teen pregnancy and things like that. We arrive, and we have a long relationship with this community. We have a meeting with the elders first. It's a wonderful meeting, middle of the night. The sun goes down, complete blackness. All I hear are voices, right? It's pretty eerie. And they're telling me, okay, we like that you're here. You're going to start your clinic. It's wonderful. I know you want to talk to the kids. I know you have demonstrations to do. You can do all that. You can talk all you like. All we ask is don't give out any condoms. Say, but why? Why do you think they would say that? The prevailing opinion amongst many of these communities is if you give out condoms, it encourages sexual behavior. Okay? We know that's not true. That's what they believe. I said, okay, I guess that's fair enough. We won't do that. So, as we continue our activities during the week, the kids follow us around, and they're asking us for condoms. I know you got condoms. Give some condoms. So, what do? Do you give them the condoms or not? You lack problems. Who says you do? Who says you don't? Okay, who's too chicken shit to put their hands? All right, let's go with why don't you?
I think I would say to not cause trouble in the community, seeing that, or I'm saying no for now, but then maybe go back to the elders and find a common ground, but from the get-go, I wouldn't just want to totally have them on my dad's side.
Okay, there's a hand over there.
I would say no, just because I'm assuming, like, are these, like, young high school kids? Like,
you're like 13, 14, 15, 16.
Okay, well, like, technically then their parents are still, like, the guardians. And so in your opinion, like, I would consider maybe approaching their parents and seeing if, like, maybe they would have a different view outside of, like, that of the elders. But I wouldn't feel comfortable being a 13-year-old
okay.
kid.
His hand down here in the front row. Did you want to?
Yeah. If you want to do further activities in the community, you have to have the diversity.
Okay.
That is more sustainable and more important than giving some comments to kids.
Okay. There's no right answer to this, but I'm with you. Okay, and this is here's how I thought it through. Let's say you give them the condoms. You have enough to last a month maybe. Okay. The elders find out it was you, because who else could it have been? You're not invited back, right? A month later, they're having sex with condoms again, and you can't come back and do the good things that you were doing. So what did you accomplish, really? You delayed something bad by a month. Whereas my logic was, we adhere to what the elders want, and incrementally with more visits, make some behavioral change. Okay? There's no right or wrong answer, but I think my logic is pretty solid. But it's a tough thing to do. So I'm going to throw in a little wrench, because this actually happened. When we decided not to, the men of the community, and the men are always useless, okay? This community, the men, they're in the back, you're drinking the cassava, right? The men approach us and say, you know, we know you're in a tough position. Just, when you go, just leave us the condoms. We'll give them out when you're gone. No one knows you. Is that a solution?
I still think that's just too bad, because the elders seem to know something was up. Like, you got the condoms from somewhere.
Okay, that's one half of it. What's the other half of it?
And you don't know if they're even going to distribute it. Like, they might just keep it for themselves.
They probably sell it. Right? So one of the great dangers of any kind of development work is you create economies where economies should not be made. You add, you turn things into commodities that shouldn't be commodities. Okay, that's one example. Get to another example in a second, because these are good stories. All right. So that's, look at that, that's dried cassava. So that's how you store it in the interior. So that's how you get by from village to village, and people just jump on, you know, from village to village. Hey, you go another, I'll go. I mean, one time, a 5-year-old girl gets on. She wants to go visit her family. And they're very competent. Yeah, I'm fine. Take care of herself. She does her own like, cooking and everything and takes care of herself. She keeps moving. So we coddle our kids way too much, in my opinion, says the childless guy. So lovely photo of a woman. This is the community I was talking about with the residential high school. When I say high school, we're still talking about the same structure as I talked about earlier. This is all the hygiene takes place down here. The kids go down and have their baths in the morning and brush their teeth there and everything. Bugs, lots of bugs, that's a leaf bug. Is there, again, you think of Amerindians living in the jungle, you don't think of this. This is what the reality is. That's how we make our, what we drink the river water. One of our clinics. Okay, that's cool. Those are rhinoceros beetles. They're edible, so you know. But I remember my first nights, you know, in the tent, because we stay in tents, we're out there, nowhere else to stay. And wake in the middle of the night, I gotta go pee really badly, turn my flashlight, and the ground outside is writhing. I'm gonna hold it. Right, we're bugs. Okay, so one of the things that I did when our, because I'm not a clinician, I'm a PhD, when our doctors are dealing with patients, here's the waiting room, we see that as an opportunity to engage in health education. So do a little Q&A, we did a lot of, call it street theater. My thing is I tell funny jokes, right? So, and I'm a local, so I can fake it. And we make fun of people, and we do little tricks, you know, and get them to trust me. And then we start asking questions about, you know, do you know this about your body? Do you know this about nutrition and health? And get them engaged as they're waiting to see a doctor. And that's a way, I think, of having a more deeply felt understanding of the principles of health. And the population is desperate for information. They always come, and afterwards I'll hang on and ask you a question. And by the way, the questions they're asking, in my experience, are never the ones that the NGOs seem to think they want answered. And that got me thinking about, is there a way to do a needs assessment from the grounds up, what people really want, that's not agenda-driven from the top down? Because most, in my opinion, a lot of development projects are driven by donor agendas. You know, we have this grant to do maternal and child health. Let's do that. Do people really want that? You know, in Guyana, for example, HIV is prevalent, but has almost nothing to do with drug use. It's entirely sex-based. And yet we have, you know, drug exchange programs being pitched all the time. Why? Because someone's willing to fund it. That's why. Right, so I got off on a tangent there. But as a result, and I'll show you the project we did later on in a second, I passed around a hat to all these communities when we do these sessions. I said, write down your questions for me. And I'll pick a random one every day and I'll answer this question. And stupid ones like, you know, my girlfriend won't have sex with me. What do I do? You ask nicely. or something like that. And then we kept all these pieces of paper, and that became a database of what people really want to ask questions about, because they're anonymous. And you can say that, you know, the literate ones are the ones that are giving answers. Yeah, there's a bias here, but there it is. That's a church in Lenore. Oh, cute little kids. That's great. I showed this to my parents. The first thing they said was, oh, look, some have shoes. Because my parents, you know, come from extreme poverty from this area. And I'm like, wow, look at that. Never thought about that. It's true. There's still distinctions of levels of poverty. Shoes and no shoes. This is a primary school. A huge, huge open schoolhouse. This is where we did our sex presentations. And by the way, I was halfway through a condom demonstration when I got the tap saying, oh, that's enough. No more. Right. So there's open-mindedness, but there are limits. Okay, this is a prison. The Mazarin prison in the middle of the jungle. And we took a trip there on one of our expeditions to give care. So we had our little mass unit set up there, and the doctors would have the patients line up and give care. And I took an opportunity to look at our data and see what are people presenting with? What are these prisoners suffering from? And try to compare it to other prison data from around the world. We published that. I'll show you what the data looks like. So we published that article. What we found were a lot of musculoskeletal issues and a lot of fear of tuberculosis and a lot of stuff that was based on the food. But more importantly, what I think I surmised was people were just desperate for social contact. So someone, you know, listening to the problems. It was quite sad, actually. That, my friends, is the water supply for one community. That was a February, I think, of 2011. I show that to point out the other big thing affecting every community around the world, disproportionately affecting low-income communities and tropical communities. What is that thing I'm talking about? The thing that will dominate your life for the rest of your adult lives. Okay, yeah, but bigger than that. Sorry? Climate change, exactly. It will, when you start looking for it, you see it everywhere, and it's kind of horrifying. So this is an example of a place that should have been flowing with water this time of year, and yet wasn't. So this is the water for cooking, for cleaning, for drinking, for everything. And you can probably imagine the kinds of deleterious health outcomes that come from this quality water. Now, a couple things to think about. One is, yeah, there are ebbs and flows of water supply, but the thing about climate change is that the changes are unpredictable. So when in the past you have generations of data to draw from, say, well, you know, my forefathers told me that in February there'll be a couple weeks of drought, whatever. Now it's, hey, it's March and there's no water at all. Where did that come from? Right, so it's a bit of a crisis going on globally. So we have a little project trying to predict the effects of climate change in these communities from Health Up. I'm about to publish that. Oh, I showed this to my students one year because they're complaining, oh, you got to go to the jungle for reading. Lucky you. No, it wasn't lucky me. Look at my foot. So there are actually things living in those bites, bot flies and things like this. My girlfriend fished out a, you know, thing once. So... This is, so we do TV shows over there as well, so it's a local TV show in Barnica. This is hilarious. So people phone in with their medical problems. It's hilarious, but also concerning. So, you know, it's a live show, and a call-in show, and they'll ask us things like, you know, I've got this strange bruise here, what do you think it is? And my favorite one was someone called, and very serious, calling saying, yeah, when I'm having sex with my wife, I get these cramps in my leg. What do I do? And our doctor says, you should take a break and stretch. Yeah, that's a good idea. So you get some wacky questions. My first ever press conference I did there many years ago, I was so scared, right? I went for advice from the Canadian embassy. And their PR people said, yeah, just, you know, do it professionally, but be prepared for the weird questions. And sure enough, press conference, introduce it. Our new project's happening. We have our experts here. Please ask questions. First question, are you married? Yeah, I don't know whether that's an invitation or actual curiosity. Okay, another thing we tried to do was try to develop tools for village education. So there is an educational crisis across the world in low-income countries, but that crisis manifests in different ways. In Guyana, it's a crisis around basic science and math education, and I found that to be the norm in a lot of countries. It's not that the teachers aren't there, it's not that the students aren't willing, it's that the tools for education aren't available. So in this particular country, the government has built the schoolhouses and sent the teachers. The students are showing up, right? But how do you teach physics without things to do experiments with, right? So I tried to develop a set of experiments you can do with strings and shadows and sticks and rocks. We got pretty far. I was able to measure the size of the earth with a stick. Pretty cool, huh? Right? But that just became an intellectual exercise and wasn't able to translate that to a product that we can share. One of my students, on the other hand, she was great. She actually put together a great brochure aimed at low-literacy Guyanese individuals around nutrition, and we're able to share that through most of the country of her sheer work alone, so that's amazing. So there are things you can do with just a little bit of imagination that don't require you to have some brilliant idea that's transformative. Just a simple idea can really make a big difference. This is actually the public school from my village. Went there once and there's some, had to give a talk. It's me showing off a finger. This pinky will save your life one day. Okay. Some of the things we're working on. Snake bites are a big problem. There are about 7 poisonous snake species in this country. And snake bites are a problem worldwide, especially in tropical areas. And the more we encroach upon previously undeveloped areas, the more we interact with the local flora and fauna. And the incredibly poor people don't have shoes, and they'll be the ones entering into the high grass more likely, and the ones being bitten all the time. How do you treat a poisonous snake bite? Well, you gotta make antivenom. You make antivenom with a large mammal and a centrifuge, and those two things don't exist in the jungle. By the way, you get the snake to bite the large mammal, it creates antibodies, you suck it out, that's the antivenom. That's how you do it. So I try to look into other ways of making antivenom, just as a side project. This is a side. On my weekends, make antivenom. So we'll see what comes out of that. Another thing we thought about doing that we couldn't get funding for, we still might try at some point. By we, I mean me and whatever student wants to come with me. is one of these schools in the interior, we thought about we could make it into an epidemiology research center. So create a curriculum whereby the teacher will teach every generation of students the basic skills of disease measurement, of prevalence estimation, and then put together a report, and they could use that report to advocate for their own social needs with the government. Otherwise, let's say there's a mining camp down the road. This actually happened. And they've come to me and said, you know, we think the mercury that the mine is pumping in the water is creating birth defects in our kids. I said, well, have you told someone? Yeah, we told the government. They sent some guy, he looked around and said, no, I don't think so, and he left. So what are you going to do? I said, well, I can't do anything because I haven't gotten the data. I can't stay here all year and collect year-round data. But you can do that. So one thing we can do is maybe train locals to collect their own data, make it into an ongoing educational experience, and they can create that as being their own advocacy tools they can take to others and say, look, this is actually happening to us. It's a big idea. It's yet to move forward. We'll see. Okay, I mentioned that needs assessment project. So this is what the actual piece of paper. There are several hundred that they wrote for us. Look at this. My penis pains me. Yeah. What is this family planning you speak of? So it's all kinds of random stuff. But what we found, we published that, what we found was there's almost no correlation between what they're asking and what the agendas of the NGOs present were. Is that indicative of something? Maybe. It requires further investigation. My penis pains. All right. Incentives for working in Guyana. People are funny as hell, first of all. A lot of fun. English speaking. Mostly, sort of, right? So that solves a lot of problems. It's in the same time zone as us. Solves a lot of problems. If you travel a lot like I do, staying in the same time zone is huge. Somewhat Western values. I say somewhat because I mentioned there is conservative culture in some ways, but heavily sexualized. Heavily sexualized. So we sent students into the interior. One of my colleagues tried to prepare the young women this way. Said, says, how do I explain how sexualized and charismatic the men are? Think of Professor Dionandan. He was born there. He left when he was 2. Look how out of control he is. Now think of somebody who's actually lived there. So I take that as a, you know, I'm pride in that comparison. But it's, right? So chances of offending someone are actually much smaller than they would be in a different kind of culture. It's hard to step on toes there, but it is, you know, it's still a different place. It's enormously cooperative, meaning that people want to be taught, they want to be a partner, they want to cooperate. I've worked in places, I won't say where that is definitely not the case. They see you as a busybody, ne'er-do-well, know-it-all, but not the case here. That helps a lot. It's nearby. And they like Canadians. It's a long history with Canada. And in fact, Guyanese people know more about Canadian politics than most Canadians do. It's kind of creepy. Here are the barriers. Corruption is present, like in all low-income countries. So any minister you're dealing with, you're never quite sure what he's saying, whether it's the truth, whether the money that you bring in will end up in the right project, things like that. Okay, donor coordination. Have you talked about donor coordination in your program yet? Because this is a big problem you will come across in this field. Let me give you an example. With the CETA project, we were brought in to develop, among other things, a handbook for how to do HIV care, palliative care, amongst others. Okay? And we brought in local experts, and stakeholders to make it specific to the Guyanese case. We spent a long time making this product. Then, a few years later, the Americans showed up with their millions of dollars. He says disdainfully, right? I gotta be careful what I say because I'll be recorded, right? He says disdainfully. And they said, we're going to do the same thing for you. And they actually brought in their generic handbook they used in Africa and just like crossed off Africa and put in Guyana and made some other changes. And we were livid. Says, what the hell is this all about, you know? And the minister actually told us, look, you did your bit, you know? You came, you did your bit, just go away. What's the big deal? He says, no, the big deal is we actually want, we don't want them to be spending their money duplicating what we just did. Right? So in that case, there was poor donor coordination. There should be a strong local leader that's able to say, we need you to do this and you do that. Don't do the same thing. The problem is, if you're both coming with millions of dollars, there's a strong incentive to, I'll take your money, sure, do what you want. Okay? So early on, around the table, literally around the table, there are one or two stakeholders. At the end of a project, there are 12 to 20 stakeholders. Several NGOs, the Europeans showed up, the Japanese showed up. Then suddenly, after PEPFAR, that's what PEPFAR is, right? After PEPFAR, the religious organizations started coming up too. So the table got crowded pretty fast. And it takes a strong local government to manage those voices. Because someone's saying, you know, we need a maternal child health policy. Maybe we do, but so, you know, yes, but there's an epidemic of Shigella happening over here. That's priority wise. And whoever's got the most money tends to shout the loudest. So it takes strength to manage that. So you will encounter that a lot of overlap in product. Lack of capacity. So yeah, you can show up with all these big ideas, but are there people there who can actually do them? Do you have to bring your own people? Do you have to train someone? So there's a lot of startup expense and effort. And by the way, you're looking to build a career. You know, one of the easiest ways to start getting your first taste of all this when you've got some skills is go to the website of a large funder like CETA or USAID, look who just got some money, because they're about to scale up. Just target them. It's a simple strategy, no one ever does it, so just do that. Because lack of capacity affects even NGOs. Go, incompetence. We all suffer from incompetence, a bit there. Apathetic officials, security issues, I mentioned, you know, our manager getting a tank. I say tank, I mean just a vehicle with extra armor. It wasn't actual a Sherman tank or anything. Things like that. I mentioned history, right? So colonialism is very, very, very important. Think about it this way. Think about, I said I'd mention India, I haven't yet. Let's mention India now. Think about if you are a poor village woman in India and suddenly you go to see a visiting doctor, a white male doctor from Britain. And he's advocating that you do a certain procedure that has some risk associated with it. And you must make a decision as a poor Indian village woman about whether or not to undertake this risk. Is there something about your relationship with this doctor that may compel you to choose one way or the other? What is that thing?
Lack of trust.
Lack of trust. That lack of trust comes from something. There's a history of colonialism between India and Britain. Right, there's been generations of being taught that the white British doctor knows more than we do. We should trust him because he knows best. He may not know best. Probably doesn't know best. Right? So colonialism plays into informed consent a lot. We can bully our way through things simply by being from a powerful country. I've walked into ministers' offices in other countries who know who the hell I am, whereas locals would have to wait in line for days. Why? Because, not because I'm special, it's because I represent Canada, and that has a certain weight to it, and that's not fair. So colonialism has advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is that you can get stuff done that maybe you shouldn't be getting done. And the disadvantage is that people will defer to you even when you're wrong. And this is one example. I mentioned racism. Industry, meaning the role of mining companies and things like that, and strategic importance. So once I was in Guyana, and in the hotel I was staying at, there are all these American Rangers, high caliber special forces, hanging out in the lobby in their military uniforms. And I said, dudes, what are you doing here? I said, oh, we're building schools. I said, okay. And you know, of course, being what I am, I hang out and try to listen in. And they were talking to, yeah, like the sub's parked to the, up the coast and bringing in the heavy machinery later on. You're not building schools out of a submarine, you know? So what they're actually doing, probably, is working on some kind of strategic element there, because Guyana is positioned in the drug trade between Colombia and North America. So they're establishing a presence. But it's whatever. I have a funny story I'll tell you later, maybe, about meeting a Russian soldier who perhaps spoke more than he should have about what he was doing. So, okay. Oh, that's that. So, one time, there's a parade in Guyana, celebration called Mashramani. It's a Native American celebration the entire country goes through. And it's a big parade. And they wanted me to help represent the Ministry of Health in this parade. And our theme was HIV/AIDS. Okay, and they said, yes, and you, Ray, here's a big joke, you are going to represent abstinence. Right. So that is the official outfit of abstinence. I don't know why. It's supposed to be old-fashioned, you know, tuxedo, whatever it is. So, yeah, there's my students. Oh, that's me, the thing. Okay. Oh, look at that. Those are manatee. You know, sea mammals? Sea cows, rather, sorry. What I'm not showing there is the pollution, all the garbage that they're under. So sad. All right. Last slide, but I can talk forever about this. So some things, before I talk about the slide, let's talk about another ethical conundrum to work through. So same community as before, right? That conservative community with the high school kids and all that. And one night we're awakened by a family that for some reason wants our opinion on something. And they have a 13-year-old daughter who is pregnant by her 35-year-old boyfriend. Okay? Yeah, that's what it is, right? So, and of course, we're talking about it, and our team is just up in arms. This is ridiculous. This girl, if she has this baby, her life is over. She'll be dropped out of school, you know, she'll be a single mother, all her opportunities done. So they start making plans to smuggle her out and give her an abortion in the neighboring community and pretend it's a miscarriage and all that stuff. What's the problem with that? It seems to solve the problem in that it allows her to go back to school, it removes the stigma from her family, people pretend it didn't happen. So what's the problem with smuggling her out?
Well, she has parents. Did she agree to not have a baby?
That's a good question. Right? So it's so funny. Whenever I talk about this example, every audience has different reactions to it. The medical students rarely jump to that position. They jump first to the idea that, we have to get her out of there, we have to get an abortion, because that's the end of her life. It's, you know, and it actually might be true that it is the end of her functioning life in that respect. She's birthed a baby for the rest of her life. But yeah, it turns out that all the family wanted was for us to somehow guarantee that the boyfriend would pay child support. And we're talking about getting her, because it's a conservative community, they're anti-abortion, they'd find out somehow, they'd find out we did it, and all this other stuff. That one's easy. Okay, not the big conundrum I hope for. All right, fine. Here's another one. Same community. Well, similar community down the road. This is a very medical one. So there's an old man. Mind you, these medical missions happen once every few months, maybe years, and quite remote area. And there's an old man who we can't really communicate with. He speaks the local tribal language, Akawayu. None of us speaks Akawayu. And by some sort of hand movements and stuff, we surmise that he has a genital urinary problem. We can't talk to him. But his neighbor says, I'll translate for you, I speak Akawai. So what do? Do you let the neighbor translate? Why or why not?
Go,
hands.
I mean, like, you could have the neighbor translate, like, there's not... Like, if the man is comfortable with it, but I don't think, like...
How do you know he's comfortable with it?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, like,
You could ask him that question to the translator.
Well,
like,
but...
I don't want this guy here, like,
but he's trying to say, oh, that means yes in our language.
Well, I don't know, but, like, so say you get past that obstacle and you just assume that this man could translate. I don't think like you would make any sort of like medical diagnosis or any sort of.
Yeah, there might be a lot lost in translation. Maybe it doesn't matter.
Remember the weight of this experience is that if we don't treat him, he may never get treated. Okay, so is that taint? The hand over here, next.
I was just gonna say I would put myself in his shoes and that I wouldn't be listening. I wouldn't wanna have someone translate such a personal topic, so I would assume that you wouldn't either want him and then for the new school in the community.
Sure.
Yes.
And his penis falls off. And everyone knows, I'm not a penis. So.
Well, I guess I'd ask through the translator and let him know. Well, I would tell the translator to let him know that this is your only chance.
Can you trust the translator?
Can I trust the translator?
I guess you don't have much of another choice, right?
Do you?
Well, you can always have the translator as like a confirmation. So like, say you think it's like a urinary problem. Hey, the translator says like it's something wrong with the foot, is it doing something completely off? And it's kind of like, oh, I don't really trust them, but if you actually confirm what you're already thinking,
see,
then maybe you could kind of go with it.
Okay. There's no right or wrong answer to this, obviously. This is a real life scenario. And there are strong medical ethics that prevent a clinician from allowing a second party to go into it.
So. Also, like, I think the problem is, so, like, I've done that where, like, we visited a community and we had a translator with us. A lot of the time, like, the translator already knows what the professionals want to hear.
Yeah.
And will kind of, like, shape the dialogue or shape what they're saying to kind of help that local person, which is problematic.
Well, I found a solution.
What's your
solution? I got lucky, right? We sent a runner to another village to find a clinician who speaks both languages. Right? So, found a medic, one of his medical extenders, which we took the boat over and she translated for us. Got lucky there. But push came to shove, I would have advocated for us to allow the translator to do it. Even though it probably violates a lot of ethical rules, only because he probably would not get treated otherwise. Right? But it's a tough one. Both sides are absolutely correct. Creepy, huh? I love his ethical things. Are they great? What other one? Okay. These are standard ones now. We'll go back to Guy in a second. This is a famous one from India. In India, there's in a community in Rajasthan, which is a desert community, there are some wells that are safe to drink from and some wells that are not as safe to drink from. And the problem is people forget which wells are which, or the wells kind of, you know, some are unlabeled and things like that. And an NGO cleverly said, well, you know, these are illiterate people, some don't speak the same language, well, let's just send the word out that from now on we're going to paint the outside of the good wells green and the outside of the red well of the bad wells red. And they did that. So everyone knows good wells are green, bad wells are red. Well, what happens? Yes.
It's like a game of telephone, right? Something a kid makes up. Or maybe in, like, I know there's, like in China, the stoplights are completely different colors. So.
They are? Damn. I didn't know that. Yes.
The cultural context of the colors.
Good guess, that's not happened.
Wouldn't it cause more people to go to the green wells? And then, so if there's too many people going to that well, people might then just go to the red wells still.
You're kind of there. It's not the too many went. Something else happened. What the underlying theme to a lot of these examples is that very often, whenever we do something, we make things worse. And we make things worse by not considering the cultural context and by not considering how we inculcate something that has no value to suddenly have value. Right? Kind of like the example I gave earlier.
The condoms.
Thank you. Yes, the condoms. Right? Back drugs. Right? So suddenly, green wells have value, more so than red wells. And India, being a classless society, suddenly a new caste emerges, the green well versus red well caste, to the point where those members of the community that already have some sway and power are the green well people. And these are you guys, you're red well people. You go there and, you know, expose yourself to whatever dangers that is. Got so bad that, in fact, there are matrimonial ads being taken out. Greenwell family seeks daughter for Greenwell son. Right, because right, the danger is always. And I think more times than not, we do more damage than good. If ever I leave my students with one message, that is, when in doubt, don't do anything. If you have any doubt at all, really think it through. Another good example, the gasifier machine. I wish I had this a slide of it. You know what a gasifier machine is? Yeah. Sorry?
The wood burning machine that turns.
Close. Okay, gasifier machine this. It's got two holes. Yeah?
Yeah, right?
Big holes. And there's a pipe that connects them. And this hole is open, and this hole has this drum on top of it. And into this hole, we put cow dung, or any kind of dung, and some wood chips, and some water, and you mix it together, and it ferments. And the methane goes through the pipe here and raises the drum of this hole. So suddenly we have this collection of methane, and this is piped into a shed, which is used to run a generator. And suddenly, with shit and wood, we've created electricity for free for the entire village. And the is ecologically friendly. There is no smell. Yeah, there's carbon dioxide, but it's not a whole lot. And the remaining stuff is a very high potency fertilizer. Wonderful. The engineers showed up and started building these things en masse in all kinds of places. So, remember the lesson here. We always make things worse. We add value to stuff that has no value, and we forget the social context. So what bad thing arose from the gasifier intervention?
So the inputs suddenly had value?
Mm-hmm. So,
cow
shit has value all of a sudden. It created an economy of cow shit. So, not everyone owns cows in the community. So suddenly, the people who own cows say, hey, I'm putting all the shit in here. How can you guys get to use your electricity, whereas my shit is running your shit? Right? So what's the solution there? You could do that. Let's say you've got no shit except your own, which is not what I'm going to put there. Is there a solution? And this could be your job one day to find these kinds of solutions. The solution has to be a social solution, not a technological one.
Well, the electricity has to be for free.
It doesn't have to be. It already is communal. That's the problem. It's communal, but the inputs are not communal. So some people feel disenfranchised. Is there a hand over here? No? Yeah.
Probably offer to upkeep the ones that have cows at the farm, stuff like that. So find non-economic ways.
Okay.
So
okay.
We'll keep your farm. We'll take care of any new machinery and all of that.
That's a very interesting idea. And that has value to it. I'm a little hesitant around that idea because suddenly you're creating almost a servant class, right? But the solution they found was, not we, but they had nothing to do with this, that remember, it's not just cow shit, there's wood chips also. So your contribution could be, I will get the wood chips. Therefore, I'm contributing just as much as you are by leading your cow there. Interesting stuff, huh? I say it again, in my experience, technological interventions always cause more problems than they solved, unless they're really well thought out. The classic example is the dam. Right? I'm sure you study dams, yes, in development studies? Yeah. Right. Okay. So what's the problem with dam? Build a dam, hey, everyone's happy. Why not? What's wrong with dams?
Crazy floodplain.
Floodplains, right? And also the quality of the effluent water you get is graded by your distance from the dam. And you're creating standing water, mosquitoes, things like that. So all kinds of negative aspects. Technology rarely solves problems outright. Says, I got a physics background. I love technology. It hurts me to say that. So let's go back to Guyana for a second before I go off on a tangent again. So final thoughts about Guyana. Ethics, we talked about the ethics of it all. Right, so anytime you go into a community like this that is particularly vulnerable, especially the Amerindian population, the temptation to be colonial, to be imperial, is so great, even for those of us who mean well. In fact, for us, it's the worst. At least the assholes are always assholes. Like, you know, stay the way. But those of us who are do-gooding and want to do well, it's our zeal that gets us in trouble all the time. We fail to see how much we're imposing our own viewpoints on others. Amerindians are a desperately in need population. but I don't want us to infantilize them. They are smart, capable people, and we need to always respect their desires of how they want to engage with our population. Globalization, what does that have to do with anything? Well, it has to do with the desire for their products, and also what the IMF is doing there, and also why the American military is there, and also why there's a gold mine there. All these things are not in a vacuum. They're there because Guyana and other countries exist in collaboration with a huge multinational economic structure. I mentioned donor coordination, which to me is, because when I started doing this, I was actually a fairly naive development guy. I was an epidemiologist. I'm all about the techniques and the science. And I show up and I see these management issues that are percolating through development. And I was stunned. That opened my eyes a lot. So donor coordination to me was stunning. The fact that agendas trump, well, logic very often. Needs assessment. How very often we don't do, in my opinion, the right kinds of needs assessments. We're doing top-down needs assessment. What does the government want to spend money on, meaning who they want to take money from? Not so much on what's best for the community. And we talk a lot about this in development studies, you know, bottom-up stuff, community engagement. What does it really mean? Right? I know this class is all about that, but what does it really mean? How do you measure community engagement? You know, at what point do you compromise community engagement to get shit done? Because the community may want, well, we want to do exactly this with just the left-handed women, whatever, you know, and that's not realistic because the donors won't allow it, so things have to be compromised. And the role of history is critical, right? I don't think it's possible to really know what you're doing in a coming country unless you really understand its history. You'll never really understand its history, so you've got to have people with you who do. There's nuance in place that affects everything. In Guyana, it has to do with race, history of colonialism, and weird relationships with Britain and America that a regular development worker would not get. That's my advantage there, coming from the culture. You know, I get that a little bit. And also, though, you know, the gender dynamics and stuff is subtly different from other places. Climate change, I said before, I think is going to be the thing that dominates your adult lives if you go on in anything, any kind of study. That's how big it is. I don't know if you've got lectures on it yet, but the more I study it, the more it horrifies me. The word apocalyptic comes to mind. I'm kind of glad I'm middle-aged and I'm going before you, so I don't get to see how it turns out. Right? So by some measurements, I've heard some senior people tell me that a best-case scenario, civilization will not fall. So... But who knows, you know? Information technology. I didn't talk about information technology. So one of our projects was building that health information system. I do believe that information technology is a safe way to invest your career in development studies, and an ethical way, and a powerful way that will actually change lives for the better. So there's something called the digital divide. You know what that is? Right? That's the, some people have access to technology, other people don't. That's the first layer of all this. The second layer is the use of these technologies to empower low-cost and efficient development. Health information systems are an obvious way to do this. That's a way for us to detect epidemics quickly, a way for us to follow patients. It's a way for us to manage costs, a way for us to look for abuse of the system as well. So I encourage you, if you're scared about your career, to think about maybe looking into that path as a way to, you know, build some value in your lives. That's enough, right? Got any questions? I can take this on. I can talk forever, so I'll stop. No questions? Nothing? Really? Does my hair? No? Yes?
Can you tell us the story about the Russian
now? Oh! All right. I'm going to pause this before I tell the Russian story. Okay. Hey, audio. Actually, I've already written my website. Okay. Pause.